A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Slavery and the City, a three-part series brought to you by the Open City Podcast. This series is about Britain's role in the transatlantic slave trade and its legacy embodied in the City of London.
The biggest gathering London has seen in weeks and one of the most passionate.
What do we want? Justice! What do we want?
Justice! Justice!
It is embedded in every brick. It's the underside of modernity, right?
The reckoning of the contradictions that are at stake, they aren't confronted.
Through an in-depth examination of three key buildings in the capital, this series attempts to uncover Britain's role within the Black diaspora, how it profited directly and indirectly from the slave trade, and question how architecture continues to convey cultural and social power in 2021. The iconic pediment on the City of London's Royal Exchange depicts a shackled African man kneeling alongside traded commodities. This is our starting point. The Royal Exchange is a Grade 1 listed building, which occupies the symbolic centre of the City of London. Through conversations with experts in Black studies and African architecture, this episode is about getting a grip on the architectural grammar of empire and colonialism.
These are difficult histories, and indeed, particularly when power indeed and finance mix.
So you cannot separate racism from capitalism. One does not emerge without the other.
I'm Selassie Setifer, and this is Slavery in the City. The tipping point came on the 25th of May, 2020, when George Floyd, a 46-year-old African-American accused of using a counterfeit $20 bill, was killed by police in broad daylight. Incubated by a global pandemic and national lockdowns, the ensuing wave of protests called for an urgent reassessment of the racial inequalities within society. Since the death of George Floyd, we've witnessed public debate on various societal issues unified by systems of discrimination and injustice. One far-reaching consequence has been the debate on architecture and the built environment and how it symbolizes and embodies the legacies of slavery, empire, and colonialism. In this episode, we're examining how buildings become imbued with cultural significance.
I'm Kyandy Andrews, Professor of Black Studies at Birmingham City University and author of The New Age of Empire, How Racism and Colonialism Still Rule the World.
I wanted to find out how we begin to define key terms and mechanisms like empire and colonialism.
Well, I mean, colonialism simply is when one country controls another country for reasons to basically take its resources. I mean, it's always an imbalanced relationship. The purpose of colonialism is that you take from. There's different kinds of colonialism. So Britain, the British Empire, was based on a kind of distance, colonialism at a distance. And this is when you have empire, when you take lots of different countries and you run them and rule them from afar. And like the British Empire was one of the largest empires in history. At its peak, it was 24% of the entire globe. And, you know, it was just this huge, vast empire. So imperialism is the kind of logic that runs behind empire, right? So you have this big empire, you have an imperial seat of power, and imperialism is the mechanism through which you control through empire, essentially.
What are the common mistakes that people make when using these terms?
Well, I think the real problems you have when we think about all of the terms, colonialism, imperialism, empire, is, one, it's about, certainly there's colonialism, empire, imperialism is not new, right? So that goes back historically, Roman Empire, there were empires in Africa. There's always, this has kind of been a feature. So one of the things that we do wrong is we relegate the British Empire or Western imperialism, which is the term I use quite regularly, because the key thing about the West, it really is that it is this combination of Europe who have their own individual empires, but they kind of combine, if you like, to call what we call the West or Western imperialism, which kind of includes America. And it's this kind of expansive global system. And what we, the wrong thing that we do is we assume that that's in the past, right? That finished. There was a time when the British Empire ended. Considering that Britain still actually has colonies, this is a strange thing to do, like Britain actually still colonies robbed by Britain. So technically the British Empire still actually legally exists. But more so, if you actually think about, if the premise of empire is you have an imperial seat, which could be a country, it could be a set of countries, which governs and controls large swathes of the world or other parts of the world to extract resources, labor, etc., for its own needs, then that hasn't ended at all. I mean, that's still going on. That still exists. It just exists in a different way. So the idea that we can stop, there's a time when empire stops and we're in a different time, that's complete nonsense.
The scale of Western imperialism is very different to the scale of empires in ancient times. We're talking about the West being an enormous empire in and of itself that factions off into smaller nation states and their individual empires.
Yeah, I mean, that is a big thing when we say, so you think something like Western imperialism, I mean, that is a big difference. It's not just Britain, it's not just Rome, it's not just one country. It is a collection of, whatever we're going to call them, nation states. It is a system which governs literally the entire world now. Right. And really importantly, it hasn't ended. It still exists. It still carries on. It just has taken on a different form. So when someone would say, well, like, well, you know, Rome had an empire, that's all well and good. The Roman Empire is done. Like, so slavery in the Roman Empire has nothing to do with today because it's finished. Right. But this system of colonialism, imperialism of the West isn't finished. It's the same system. And so everything which happened from slavery to colonialism, even though it was 200 years ago, some of these acts, because the wealth is still with us, the system's still with us, everything's still with us, the poverty's still with us, we're still in the same thing. So just to imagine that we can just say it's ended and we're no longer responsible is complete madness.
Where does the term legacy come into this? If we're still in an age of empire, or sort of empire, does the word legacy even apply?
Yeah, 100%. Like, there are, I guess, the legacy of the Roman Empire would be Roman roads, right? Those really strong, like that. That's a legacy. But you're right. There's no legacy of the transatlantic slave trade because we're just still in the same system. So legacy really is the wrong way to look at this. History is really the wrong way to look at this as well. But unfortunately, if you actually, that is entirely the way that we understand these things, right? Historians study empire. Historians study slavery. When actually they're still with us, very much still with us in concrete ways, right? Like they haven't in any way disappeared. They're still very much shaping the world today.
The relationship between racism and capitalism. We've now touched on some of the terminologies involved in this. The question I want to ask is, why haven't we consigned racial exploitation? The question I want to ask is, why haven't we consigned racial exploitation by capitalist means to history?
You think about what the West is. The West is kind of defined by capitalism, right? By that expansion of industry and finance, and that leads then to democracy, et cetera, et cetera. So capitalism and the West, you can't really separate the two of those things. But you also can't separate capitalism from racism. Because what is it that defines the West? What is it that makes the West more than anything else? It's racism, right? Like literally without racism, there is no West. It doesn't happen. Capitalism doesn't emerge, which is why 1492 is the year. That's the really important year. It's why when Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue and went the wrong way and found the Caribbean. And this unlocks, I mean, this really does unlock the West, because this allows a place where at the time in the 15th century, Europe was the only place of the part of the world that was in the dark age. Like literally most of the world was way more advanced. Africa was more advanced than Europe. Asia was more advanced than Europe. Even the Americas were more advanced than Europe. And when Columbus takes that wrong turn and unleashes like a reign of terror over the Americas, which leads to a genocide, which is the largest genocide in human history. And so if you think about the logic of empire and the logic of the Western empire, particularly, it is that white life is sacred and that the lives of black and brown people are disposable. And it starts off, it's kicked off with this huge genocide of the people in the Americas. And that unlocks the door for Europe to expand into the West. Then this is where you start to give slavery in the Americas. And like I said, at this point, Europe's behind. And it really is first by finding gold and silver in South America and in the Caribbean. This is used to kind of enrich. You find there's lots of this kind of gold and silver boom that kind of starts to get the way Europe starts to come up a little bit. Then transatlantic slavery is really the thing which unlocks capital. It really generates so much wealth, that triangular trade over 300 years. That's really the thing which allows you to have the Industrial Revolution. So if you think about sugar and cotton as being the two most important commodities for the Industrial Revolution, it is not a coincidence that both of those commodities are slave-produced commodities. And the wealth that's produced from that, that's what allows capitalism to happen. There is simply no capitalism without that system. And that system is obviously based on racism, right? So you cannot separate racism from capitalism. One does not emerge without the other.
My last question is, what do we mean by colonial logic?
So colonial logic, in this sense, if you think about the colonialism that we're in, Western imperialism, which is deeply defined by racism and white supremacy, and colonial logic is simply white life is valuable and black and brown life is not valuable. And again, you can see that play out all around the world today. So you see this logic of white supremacy effectively, where white life is valuable and you can see that the black and brown bodies basically are the commodities which are used to produce Western progress. First is the genocide. Then if you think about slavery, and one of the things about slavery which people often say is, you know, slavery wasn't really about racism. It just needed some people to exploit. Well, that makes no sense, because there were plenty of people they could have exploited in Europe and didn't do this, right? They had indentured laborers from Europe, but indentured laborers were treated very, very differently to enslaved Africans. Enslaved Africans were chattel, they were property, they were animals, had no rights at all, had no legal status. The case of the Zong, which I think you're going to talk about in the program, the case of the Zong, where it just shows you that literally in English law, Africans were no more than horses or cattle. That is exactly how this was never applied to white people, right? So there's something happening there very clearly about black life and about the disposability of it. And slavery, I mean, so the numbers of people we're talking about, anywhere between the minimum estimate of people who were actually enslaved is 12 million. And then the minimum estimate, again, of how many people died is about twice the amount of people died in the process of being enslaved as actually were enslaved. So that's at least 36 million. And that's the low estimate, right? And this is for three centuries. And you can just see the devaluation of black life. And in terms of trying to understand now why we're in the situation we're in, where black people are more likely to be killed by the police, more likely to be restrained, and mental health services, etc. There is no way to see that any outside of how black bodies were treated during slavery, right? And then it's not like slavery ends and this is all good. We will finish with this. Once our bodies have been disposed and used, and there's new systems of oppression, what do you see? You have this 100 years of colonialism, where the wealth from places like Africa is just ripped out of the continent. And there's a book by Walter Rodney where he says how Europe underdeveloped Africa. So for 100 years after slavery, you then have Europe just taking out resources, not building any infrastructure, etc. And then leaves the continent in a really terrible state, which again explains why Africa is still poor today. And then if you think about coming to the modern times now, when you think about where all your clothes are made, and why all our clothes and our goods are made in places like China and India, etc. Because they are on starvation wages that we would never accept in the West, right? So even now, this idea that it's fine to exploit and to abuse black and brown bodies so that us in the West can have success. And really, this hasn't changed. And the thing I always point people to is to look at GDP, gross domestic product per capita, and which is a kind of measure of how poor and rich countries are. Africa is the poorest part of the world by a distance, what they call sub-Saharan Africa. The West, a developed world where white people live, is the richest. And then you have this hierarchy in between, which means we've literally created the world in the image of white supremacy. Today, that's not 100 years ago. That's literally right now. and explains why 9 million people around the world die each year from poverty and hunger, and basically all of those people are black and brown. But we say very little about this.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
We're going to pick up these ideas about economic imperialism in our globalized world throughout this series. In the meantime, let's bring the focus back to the City of London. I'm joined now by Merlin Fulcher, fellow co-host of the Open City podcast, who can provide context on what the epicenter of the British Empire was. Hi Merlin, can you start by giving us a brief introduction? What is the City of London and where are its boundaries?
So the City of London is the ancient administrative centre of the capital. It occupies roughly the site of London's original Roman settlement, but today it's a central business district strongly associated with financial services such as banking and insurance. Although the City of London predates the rise of empire and imperialism during the 17th, 18th and 19th centuries, its power and global influence grew significantly in this same period. And much of this wealth generation came from enterprises within the square mile, which directly and indirectly benefited from slavery and indentured labour in the West Indies, the Americas and elsewhere.
Can you tell us about the building's purpose, as well as its history?
It's one of the few places in the capital where royal proclamations, such as births and deaths, are ceremonially read aloud. You know, that's kind of how significant it is. The building was created by Thomas Gresham in the mid-16th century. Gresham was an important merchant in Antwerp, when it played a key role in harnessing the profits of the early slave trade to advanced early capitalism. And he wanted to create a similar venue where London could take over that hegemony.
So the building we see today was designed by William Tite in the 1840s and replaced an earlier trading house on the same site. That earlier trading house stood at the epicenter of global finance at a time when slavery was central to Britain's fortunes. What role does the building play now, Merlin?
So the Royal Exchange, as it is now, it has shops arranged around a covered courtyard, and it's been transformed into an upmarket food, beverages and retail centre. I think the building is very significant, especially with regard to this series, and that's because of its pediment. The pediment, like the rest of the building, was built after the abolition of slavery in the British Empire in 1833. But the pediment is notable because it features in it an image of a black African man in shackles kneeling alongside other commodities.
So why is this man depicted there? Is he depicted there because it's representative of what was going on in the building, or acknowledging the fact that the building's purpose and use was in line or linked to slavery and the slave trade? Or is it something that's put there for more violent reasons to further perpetuate slavery and seeing black people as commodities? It's exactly these grey areas, these ambiguities, I wish to interrogate. How do we begin to read architecture which physically embodies Britain's role within the transatlantic slave trade? How should we classify buildings like the Royal Exchange? Do we start by defining this as colonial architecture?
Well, I mean, that's, I guess, a loaded question. Hi, I'm Ola Oduku. I'm a research professor in architecture at the Manchester School of Architecture. I have an interest in minority communities and urban centres in both the North and the South.
I began by asking Ola how buildings like the Royal Exchange come into existence and why ornamental details like the kneeling slave become immortalised in bricks and mortar.
As the money comes in, those who have made their money and created the wealth create these both houses and also these trading places. So, you know, even the exchanges and so on that we talk about in London that I know you've been looking at, you have the same kind of exchanges in places like Liverpool. And indeed, at certain points, Liverpool is probably richer than London because of the amount of money that comes in through this illegal trade. And this then becomes representational as well. So the buildings become big, much, much bigger. If we think about Liverpool being a very small city, probably Chester at the time was bigger than it was before it sort of got really involved in the trade. So the buildings become incredibly large, grandiose, and then the representation in terms of decoration and ornamentation begins to show, if you like, where the money came from, which at that time clearly was something that was, well, I don't know, I guess it was something to be boasted about until the abolitionist lobby began to challenge that. And you find the same thing. I mean, I went down to Marseille for a conference, and if you go down to the main bit where the port is in Marseille, again, the historic Marseille, you see the same thing, large buildings, people in chains. And, you know, that's the way in which a lot of the representation and decoration at the time manifested itself in these buildings.
So the richer sort of these nations, these cities, these towns got, the more they embellished their buildings to sort of communicate where their wealth was generated from.
Yeah, and I guess you could say that what's happened with the events of the last year is that, you know, there's been that challenge to these buildings that have been there for, you know, yonks. And also what's happened, of course, with time passing is there's been historical amnesia. That's a word I quite like, you know. So the buildings are there, and nobody's asking too many questions about what's actually on them and is there any link. So there's that de-link. Certainly I'm old enough to have been brought up actually in Scotland, and all we ever got told was that, again, Britain was one of the first countries to abolish the slave trade. I had no real idea about the sugar trade and its link to and the tobacco trade in Glasgow. I mean, there had been some talk indeed about some parts. I think Liverpool particularly, I think there's been a long understanding about its links, but there are other cities, as we're finding out now, that have had links as well. So there's that amnesia thing about the buildings are there, but the provenance of the ornament and so on is often much more difficult to find out about, or has become over time.
Thanks for that. I think the next question, kind of linked to that as well, is this: when we speak about dominant ideologies and how they become embedded within the built environment, you speak about this amnesia. Do you think, first of all, do you think these dominant ideologies matter, and them being embedded in the built environment, do you think they matter? And if you do think that, why? If you don't, also why?
Well, I think definitely the way we see history is always influenced by what the dominant state is. So I'm going to take you back the other way. So, I mean, I was brought up partly in Scotland and partly in Nigeria. And in Nigeria, oftentimes as well, there's a bit of amnesia about the slave trade. So the idea about there being middlemen and so on isn't fully explained. So it depends on where you are, on what side of the coin you are, as to what you understand as your history. And history at its best should be giving an equal and balanced view about, you know, what has happened over time. So it should neither, it shouldn't promote one side over the other, but we should be able to have an understanding about the things that happened and those, the players and the characters. And in some ways, one should try to keep as level an understanding as to what was happening as is possible, which is very difficult, definitely. But the idea about there being right and wrong is obviously in the eyes of which side of the discussion you're having, you're looking at the activities. So I think the idea about the dominant culture is always going to be difficult because, you know, nations always tell their stories. We all have narratives, but the point is to include in the narrative the other bits of the stories that are often they're often overlooked, or indeed there is chosen amnesia around certain narratives if it doesn't fit into the ways in which we like to see ourselves. So it's a tricky thing to balance. But I think certainly what's happening is that over time, as we become much more global, these stories are becoming much more to the fore than they were, say, 20, 30 years ago, because the information is there. And you can go to various archives now and find out things. So even if the national history says one thing, you can look through the archives and find out what the other histories have said about that same time. So your viewing of a place in time is very much framed by your understanding and the context from which you're coming to the story.
Do you think that architecture in our cities can give credence to the complex context, power play, and stories of our past?
Okay, I definitely feel that buildings do have a place in giving us a good context to our cities, because generally people look at buildings, but the buildings they look at tell different stories. But if those buildings are better contextualized, and if people understand what these buildings what role these buildings have in history, in our histories, they would have a better understanding of the histories of the places in which they live. So, for example, could give an example in, actually, Nigeria would be a good one. There was a prison, the site of the original prison that was built indeed in colonial times, and indeed it was a place that also had a garret for hanging and so on. It was closed, and for about 30 years it just disappeared. But then an architect, a colleague whom I know, was able to take the land, or sort of take the lease of the land from the Nigerian government, and turn it into what's called the Freedom Park. So by doing that, he opened up that space, which again had these histories of imprisonment and so on, and turn it into a park that was open, that is open to the public. And it also tells a story about what that space had been. Now, again, which is the issue about how land values change. Generally, in a place like Lagos, land is a bit like London. A developer would have rather put a really expensive 16-story building on that space. But by, if you like, rescuing that site, with that intention, or with an intention of both turning it into something that had public interest and also was able to tell the history, you've got a much better way in which the site then gives that history back to the people.
So to me, that sounds like it's a lot to do with a conscious effort to bring that history through whatever program it is that you bring to that building. It doesn't necessarily have to be used for what it was used for or intended for in the first instance. But as history progresses, trying to reframe and rethink what the purpose of that building is and how you can tell its sort of history, I think is quite important.
That's correct. I mean, there are custodians of culture, which again, whom we often forget. And the point would be to actually work with those who remember these histories. And indeed, if there are buildings, places and so on, I guess it's partly the intangible to culture being put in direct contact with the tangible culture. So the beauty again about the prison is that it's in people's lifetimes. So my mother is actually 92 and she can remember when it was a prison. So you've still got those who remember the histories, albeit maybe just orally, and then you've got actually got the physical space. So you, if you can put them together, then you really have something that I think communities can connect with.
My takeaway is that it's incredibly important that we continue to question. We need to continue to question our histories rather than simply accept what has been taught to date. It is evident that we have not been taught the whole truth about much of our histories. Without the unveiling and in-depth understanding of all sides, whether they are right, wrong, immoral or just, how can we ever confront the past, learn from it, hold people to account, or ensure the end to systemic discrimination and injustices? These ills were seeded in the age of the slave trade, but are very much still alive today. Many of these buildings still stand and are still in use. Are their full stories being told? Are they being used to uphold systems of discrimination and injustice? How are they actively contributing to dismantle systems of discrimination and injustice? In the next episode of this three-parter, we're using the City of London's famous Guildhall to put collective amnesia on trial. I'm Selassie Setifler, and you've been listening to Slavery and the City.
This episode has been produced in partnership with the City of London Corporation as part of its drive to tackle racism in all its forms. Its Tackling Racism Task Force is leading this work, assessing what further action the City Corporation can take to promote economic, educational and social inclusion, and considering how to respond to the historical issues such as statues and monuments. You can find out more at ourcitytogether.london. If you'd like to hear our full interviews with Kayindi Andrews and Ola Aduku, sign up to become an Open City Friend and you will be able to access the full interviews with Selassie and all the amazing contributors for the series. For $1.25 a week, you can support the hosting costs of the Open City podcast, helping to keep conversations about the city open, honest and accessible. Alongside the Open City podcast, we have The Lundown, our weekly roundup of the week's top London architecture news. Tune in every Thursday morning with Merlin Fulcher and a roster of special guests.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.